This episode is brought to you in part by Geek Therapy subscribers on Twitch. You can become a subscriber at twitch.tv/geektherapy. Or if you have Amazon Prime, you can use your free Twitch Prime subscription on us. For more info on that, visit geektherapy.com/prime. Welcome to Psych Tech on the Geek Therapy Podcast Network. We're a psychology and technology program. My name is Jose Cardona with Kelly Dunlap.
Howdy, howdy.
Kelly, you just went to a conference. I want to know all about it. It sounded exciting, sort of.
That is probably the best description of the conference. Was it was exciting, sort of. And I mean that genuinely. So last week I was in Washington, D.C. for the APA-sponsored Technology Society or Technology Mind and Society Conference. So again, that's where the exciting part comes in. It sounds like it would be super exciting, right?
It sounds super exciting.
Yeah. So the first day, not a whole lot to write home about. It was mostly focused on like AI and computer intelligence, which are not like boring things, but
not to me.
They're not my cup of tea per se. I don't need to look at Bayesian networks all day. That does not stoke my fires, so to speak. And there wasn't a whole lot of mental health part of it either. So I was feeling a little doubtful, but the next day was actually much better. The second day of the conference, I mean, not only did I get to see Chris Ferguson present, which was, and meet him and talk with him, which was fantastic. I also got to see this really great symposium that was put together by the National Institute of Mental Health. And the topic that I wanted to talk about today on Psych Tech was presented by a gentleman named Stephen Schuler. And he is at the Department of Preventive Medicine at the Center for Behavioral Intervention Technologies at Northwestern University. It's a very long title.
Right. So I don't want to say anything negative necessarily about Stephen Schuler's slides, but based on all the pictures that you posted, I saw a lot of... let's say, lack of fun factor in a lot of these presentations based on their slides alone.
So I can confirm that psychologists tend not to be aesthetically talented or trained in any way. And yes, there is a lot of text and not a lot of prettiness. But thankfully the information was so alluring that I think it's worth overlooking the slides.
I'm glad to hear that because
And if you want to know what we're referring to, so I have this really long Twitter thread from when I was live tweeting it, and you can like almost follow along as we talk. But yeah, so I posted as many slides as I could with my comments. This particular talk was called Enhancing the User Experience of Digital Mental Health. And if you're not familiar, user experience is kind of a techie type term for understanding how somebody interacts with the product that you are designing. So in this case, with a digital mental health app, and that includes, you know, ease of use. How easy is it to use? How intuitive is it? How aesthetically pleasing? Does it do what the user expected? Does it do what the company that paid for this development does it meet their criteria as well? So just kind of this whole idea of UX is the shorthand, the lingo we use in the biz for user experience. Hasway, have you ever done any UX work?
So it's funny because UX, now we mostly talk about that in the sense of digital, but there is also a user experience aspect to in real life, right? There's all sorts of stuff. So I have done more on that sense. It's like, we're creating a new space or we're creating a new activity. How can we make that more, not just user-friendly, but more appealing to the eye and that it makes sense? And so we're following a certain order so that, you know, when people walk in, they know where to go to next, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, and on my own projects, yeah, UX, UI, the whole thing, talk to a lot of people. Yeah.
And you can tell because if you go to Hostway's website, it's very beautiful. It's very visually engaging. but that is not the standard for the mental health world. So one of the first pieces of knowledge that Stephen dropped was as of a 2017 report, they found over 325,000 apps that were classified as quote-unquote health apps, and estimated about 15 to 20,000 of them were specifically targeted at mental health. There's a little...
What does that mean? I want to know, like, what's the criteria for...
That's why there's a 5,000 app wiggle room in that estimate, because it's hard to tell, is an app that is purely mindfulness, is that a mental health app? So there's not a set criteria necessarily for what made it a mental health app versus not. But so the best estimate was between 15 and 20,000, which is still an obscene amount of things on the market. And the kind of the kicker was that most of these apps have really terrible long-term engagement. And he defined that as, you know, after logging on and using one or two modules, not entirely clear what a module consisted of, but after basically one or two uses, the user just stops. Like this. Now, this is a slide that is helpful. That is on my Twitter rant. And oh, it's a little blurry. I'm sorry about that. But basically, there's a graph of like how many people downloaded a particular health app, the amount of people that opened it a second time, and the amount of people opened it a third time. And you can just see like there's this enormous fall. So basically, people will download these apps, which indicates that they're really popular, but then they never use them again.
I think that's the case for a lot of apps. I wouldn't say most, but I think maybe a majority of apps, especially because it's so easy to try them out. A lot of people download them, try them once, and like, ugh. I'd also be interested in seeing, I don't know if you had this data, of how many people, and I'm not entirely sure, I think you can see this on the App Store as a developer, is if somebody downloads your app, opens it one time, and then uninstalls it. Because that would be very different, right, to how somebody installed it and then used it once, used it twice, and then they're not going to delete it because they think they're going to use it again, but they just don't, versus...
Or they don't know how to delete an app.
Or I don't want this. Or they don't know how to delete it, yeah.
I mean, I don't know how many apps are on my phone that I haven't used. Like, if they could collect cobwebs, I'm sure they would. I almost never delete an app, even if I know I have no intention of using it ever again.
Oh, I delete stuff all the time. I'll download it. I try it once. I tried one this week. It wasn't health related, but it was like it was an AR app to change the color of things in your house because I just moved. I'm about to test some things out. Yeah. No, that app was a disaster. I deleted that thing after the first use.
So basically, I mean, again, like you mentioned, it's not necessarily a mental health app or an app thing or a health app thing. It is just an app thing. You download something you think that might be interesting, and because they're usually free, there's like no risk, and then you're like, never mind, this isn't quite right for me.
But this thing, this whole part is really interesting, because I remember I spoke to Jay McGonigal once about this, and I asked her, like, well, your app is designed for, I would call it's not necessarily only a mental health app, but I would put it under that category, depending on the uses. Would you categorize Superbetter as a mental health app?
Yes.
Okay. So let's put it in that category. And then I asked her, I'm sure nobody is going to use this forever, right? That's not possibly an expectation. She was like, no, of course not. Like, people are going to use it when they need it, and then it's going to be done. And I know that in psychology and in mental health, in clinical psychology in particular, there are different schools, different theoretical orientations. And some, you know, sometimes you go to a therapist, it's like, no, this is going to be a 6-month process. Like, doesn't matter what you came in for, right? Like, you're going to be there for months. But my training, which was in REBT, rational emotive behavior therapy, when you're training in that, they're like, you know, sometimes a client might need just one session, you know, and then that's it. They got what they needed, and then they won't come back for a while until they need it again. And so I think a lot of these apps might be, it depends on what they're looking for. Like, it's hard to have such a broad category as mental health. And I'd love to see very specific case examples about this, because I think some things are, if you just have a question or a doubt, like maybe I'm assuming something like WebMD. Someone downloads the WebMD app just because they have a very specific question. And then, but they're super healthy otherwise, but this is the first time they have like an itch on the back heel, you know, of a foot. And they're like, oh, wait a minute, I want to check that out. And then they never look at it again. But other things where there are actual modules or processes that they have to follow, those might be, you know, that's like a different category in a sense.
Yeah, no, I get that. And again, I think it's so hard to imply intention or reason when all you have is the, even for a developer, the minimal amount of data that is available. So,
well, I think, but as a researcher looking at 15 to 20,000 apps that are all in one such a broad category, I'm curious about how useful those trends are, right? That, like, that statement of like, well, you know, after one or two modules, use drops. But like, can we split that up more specifically?
I'm sure he could, but he only had 15 minutes for this presentation. So, but you can, he's on Twitter and you can certainly follow up with him if you want to dig deeper into the research. It's there. It's transparency. It's very important.
You know I do. You know I want to dig deeper.
I know you do. So after he kind of gave that interesting stat, he kind of posed the question of, so why do we think this might be? Like, why are we not seeing the kind of engagement that we would want? So it could be in part to all the really tough questions that Josue is posting or positing. But he also suggested the idea of a skeuomorph, which I didn't know what it was, but it's now like my new favorite word. He said, Josue, do you know what a skeuomorph is?
I do now because of your
thing. Because you looked at the slide, yeah. Cheater. But yeah, so basically it's the idea of something that shows up in a digital form to reflect something from the past. So the example he gave in his slides was, think about a chandelier, and chandeliers now have light bulbs in them. And those light bulbs tend to be shaped like candles, or like the wick or the flame of a candle. You know, they usually have kind of the bulbous bottom end, and then they taper up like a flame would. And there's absolutely no reason that the glass should be shaped that way. It's actually probably more expensive to shape glass rather than just having it just be a sphere or any other shape. And the other example he used was the floppy disk. And apparently, I think, Josue, you and I have had a similar experience, or talked about a similar experience, where his 12-year-old saw an actual like 3.5 floppy disk and said, hey, that's really cool. You 3D printed the save icon. And so it's this idea that something that worked in its physical form gets translated over into a digital representation of that thing. And the reason he brings this up is because that transformation, it might feel like it makes sense, but there's no reason that it has to be that way. Like, there's no reason that the light bulbs on a chandelier have to be shaped like candles. It's just something that we've done, and we usually don't even think about it. And he ties this into mental health because he's basically saying that the way that we do face-to-face therapy has been skeuomorphed into a digital format. So, you know, for example, the very kind of like didactic back and forth type of strategy that happens when you're working with somebody one-on-one, the collective universal we have tried to just map that into a digital space through things like Talkspace and other mental health apps like that. Or if you're trying to do something specifically around, say, PTSD or mindfulness, it tends to be very didactic centered. Like, here, let me teach you the thing by telling you what it is, and then you can practice it, which is what we tend to do in face-to-face. But there's no, not necessarily a reason that it has to be that way. And he had this really great quote about, as we move psychology into the digital age, we need to think about the technological affordances to make better treatments. So in other words, as psych becomes more digitized, we need to think about the platform that we're using it on to inform the treatments that we're delivering to make them better.
Yeah, some of the examples that come to mind are like, if you're going to do virtual therapy, distance therapy, there's no reason why that has to be a 15-minute session, right? There's no reason whatsoever. It can be shorter. It can be longer. It can be whatever it needs to be instead of like the customary, you know, 50 minutes. But I think things like even not only just the didactic nature of it, but just the idea that being able to – is Talkspace the one that's by text?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So
you
even that is
just, have a video face-to-face, but it's that's like the super expensive plan.
Right. So even just the texting part, I think is like a big change. Just the idea that you're willing to do that instead of having to do videos face to face, and that it doesn't have to be in real time. It can be asymmetric. So you can write a question and then not expect an immediate answer is a good use of, I guess it's not a skeuomorph in a way. I mean, I get that the didactic model would still be adopting the old ways, but I think that there are, we've seen advances that that are exciting to me in that sense. Just like it doesn't have to be even something like, and this has been going on for a long time, using Second Life to do therapy or group therapy. That's still very much like people literally recreate their offices and their avatars just to have everybody sit around in a circle in a virtual space. Like, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So things like Talkspace, where they're moving to asynchronous communication or text communication, those are like steps in the right direction. They're
asynchronous.
Breaking.
I said asymmetrical. Asynchronous. Thank you.
I'm here for you. I wasn't even going to say it. I was just going to keep on going. But like that's a step in the right direction. But you know, really challenging these things that we take for granted, these things that we just automatically assume. One of my favorites is dialing a phone number. Like, has Grant will never dial a phone number. He will never have to take the dial and rotate it to call somebody. You know, and if for somebody who grew up on an iPhone, you know, they would think about tapping a phone number, but we just call it dialing because it just kind of gets carried over. It doesn't have to be that way. And having that kind of openness is really important. And then the kind of the next part of the conversation you talked about is, well, how do we kind of make those breakthroughs? Because if there are these blind spots, which we all have, because we all take them for granted, we don't even think about them. How do we kind of get at ways to change? And so he did a different study where basically he and his team reviewed a bunch of mental health apps or whatever fell into that category, and found that apps either looked good and had good UX, meaning that they were easy to use, they were visually appealing, people liked them, or they had good evidence. So very rarely did those two things interact. And I think the correlation was like 0.22. So really, really pretty low. And, you know, as researchers, sometimes, and clinicians, we hope that if the treatment is good and the outcomes are good, then it doesn't matter what it looks like. But that is not true at all. You know, if someone can't use your app or your tool, or if it's difficult and you're creating more hurdles for them to get what they need, then they're going to go somewhere else. And so that's kind of where he was hinting that we need to take kind of the iterative design process that's used in tech and especially in games, and apply that to creating empirically supported mental health apps for people.
But there's also the side of it where it may not be evidence-based now because people are just innovating. People are just trying new things. And it doesn't mean those things aren't effective. It just means there isn't a research to back it up. So how many years is it going to take for some of these things to have the evidence to back it up? I mean, the same app could in 5 years be considered empirically supported.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely not, you know, this is not a 100% certainty type of things. These are trends that he has found from his research. And I think for a lot of people, if you have gone to, say, an app that was developed specifically by a psych lab, for example. I've got a couple on my phone from when I used to do one-on-one therapy. I had one that was, you know, specifically for reporting in PTSD symptoms and like helping walk you through different techniques for like managing those. And it's an ugly app. And I tend to find that, you know, stuff that's made by a lab is ugly, whereas stuff that is made outside of a lab and with minimal, if any, kind of research support, it tends to be prettier. And so I feel like it's trying to find this middle ground between something that is healthy for you and something that is appealing. So I know a lot of times in games they talk about chocolate covered broccoli, but I hate that analogy because chocolate covered broccoli would still be disgusting. But basically you're trying to find something that is healthy or helpful for you, but also is appealing.
Of course, there are many people who won't even look at it. So they won't take the healthy thing if it doesn't look appealing, right? That's like, that's also, it's the obvious thing that's also happening. And sometimes just because it looks good, people will try it who would have never even considered it.
Yeah. I mean, if you see something and you're like, ooh, that's really shiny, I mean, I get attracted to shiny things all the time, and I don't know what they are, and mm-hmm. they might end up being terrible, but I'm much more likely to try them than stuff that, I mean, all of marketing is dedicated to that, you know, the packaging of products, whether it's stuff in the grocery store or stuff in a toy store or the local Mac store, like it's all heavily researched to how to make it visually appealing and to draw people in and to spark their interest and their curiosity and their desire. But you know, there's only so many ways you can make broccoli look attractive. I don't even know if you can. You can put a bow on it, I guess, but it's still broccoli.
I like broccoli. I eat broccoli every day.
I do enjoy broccoli, so that's probably about that example. So anyway, basically, he is positing this idea that if you have a research-based treatment that you want to make, don't just digitize it. Rather, go through this design process that is the norm for technology. And so for people listening to this podcast, that probably seems like, well, duh, you know, thanks, Sherlock. Like, thank you for helping me deduce that, because of course you should do that. But it's not the norm, at least in the psych-specific app space.
Hey, there's a brand new way that you can help support Geek Therapy and all of our podcasts, including this one. That's by becoming a subscriber on Twitch. You can visit our channel at twitch.tv/geektherapy. We stream at least twice a week, on Tuesdays and Fridays, and sometimes sporadically throughout the week. And you can see all of our archives there, so if you miss a day, you can check out the games that we played. Our goal on Twitch is to have one more place where we can talk about mental health while doing some cool stuff. Most of the time, we're just playing games and having fun, but if you have any questions about psychology, we're hoping that people will go there too. And if you have Amazon Prime, you may have something that you're not aware of. As a Prime subscriber, you have Twitch Prime, which allows you a free subscription every month to a channel of your choice. So if you have Amazon Prime, you can go to twitch.tv/geektherapy, link your Amazon account, and then use your free subscription on us. Everyone in the chat will know that you're a subscriber, you'll get access to an exclusive emoticon, and it's just one more way to support Geek Therapy, and this one is actually free for you if you already have Amazon Prime. So visit twitch.tv/geektherapy to check out our Twitch channel, and at the very least, give us a follow so you'll be notified every time we go live. Again, for information on how to use Twitch Prime, visit geektherapy.com/prime, and check us out on Twitch at twitch.tv/geektherapy. You know, we went to Games for Change a few years ago, and this theme that kept coming up, and I'm sure it's still happening because the problem still exists, and it exists in what we're talking about now, is that the people who know how to do really nice UI and UX, and the people who are doing the technical, scientific part of the part that works in the app and helps people, they're not talking to each other.
Right.
And how do you get them to talk to each other? Like, having a whole bunch of people in the lab running a design sprint isn't going to necessarily come up with something that's way better. It's going to just be a whole bunch of A-B testing, and we're going to have the best tasting broccoli or the best looking broccoli, but it's not necessarily going to be all that great. And it's funny to me that in universities that either have some sort of design program in the university itself or can partner with other universities, right? They you have students who are doing a lot of these things that would be able to help. You can give them credit or whatever. I know that there's money involved too. If you're a researcher, you have money, it's not that you're not going to. They're obviously not allocating money to the design process, because if they were, things wouldn't look the way they look. But then to have enough of that money set aside to have them be a part of the process throughout the process, because as the app is changing, then the visuals would change too. And app development is an ongoing process. So, I mean, you and I have a taste of this, right? Like, coding things change, and all of a sudden an operating system changes, or the core engine or whatever it is that we're using changes, and you have to constantly be updating that stuff. And if there's a bug that's discovered 3 months down the road, if you don't have that budget allocated, then who's going to do it? Like, the same psych researcher is suddenly going to go in and code that? Like, that's unrealistic. So maybe, I don't know, maybe universities need a bigger budget for just making things look good, like an ongoing budget.
Or they could contract out to some kind of company that is cross-qualified in design and mental health development. Just throwing that out there. Not saying that I work for such a company, although I may, but saying that those kinds of things exist.
So let's talk about that. You work for a company okay. So is that something that this company does?
So I work for a company called iThrive Games. And I am their manager of mental health research and design. So this is why this is so interesting to me, because this is kind of like my job description, is figuring out how to make these things work, to bring my knowledge of games and my knowledge of design, my knowledge of psychology, and mix it all together. And so one of the things that I do and that my company does is, you know, we talk with, mostly educators right now, but also mental health professionals about how do you take these kind of healthy edutainment type of experiences and make them actually enjoyable. And on the other hand, we also work with larger titles like AAA studios and indie developers in the game space. And like, okay, how can we make your game, you know, more pro-social? So, you know, we're not trying to stop Call of Duty from being Call of Duty, but there are things that you can do at the design stage and through UX and through UI to create an experience that might foster more of like a strength-focused approach as opposed to punishing behavior you don't want. So yeah, that is something that we are doing.
So what's that process? If I'm making an app and it's ugly, right? And then I go to iThrive. My point was that I could talk to you. I could contract iThrive for maybe a day, but like that's not enough, right? Like I think it's a money issue. You guys don't do it for free.
No, because we're a nonprofit and we need to pay people like myself.
Yeah.
But as far as the process goes, it's going to be different for every company, every person, every product. But in general, it's, hey, here's the idea. Here are the core components that are most important to this idea here. And then the next idea, or rather the next iteration, would be let's sketch it out. So whether that is literally sitting down with a piece of paper and sketching out what your interface might look like, or how somebody might navigate this app and get to the content you want. A lot of times there is a paper prototyping stage where you actually make the thing on paper. I've done that for games, I've done that for apps, and then you actually have somebody else come in and try to navigate that paper prototype. You know, does it make sense to them? There's actually a really great, for people who, it's mostly for web design, but the idea is like you ask the client how many things do you want people to be able to access? So for example, if we were, let's say an ice cream store, because I'm feeling in an ice cream mood, people would probably want to know about flavors. They'd probably want to find locations. They would probably want to find specials and things other than ice cream, and whether you sell ice cream cakes, and if they can design their own ice cream cake, and all those kinds of things. And so you basically write down all the content that you would want your website to have onto index cards, and then you do what we call a card sort. And so you put things basically into categories based on how it feels like they belong. So it would make sense to put all of the ice cream flavors in one category, you know, vanilla, chocolate, butterscotch, whatever. Whereas, you know, if you're talking about different cakes, they might go into a separate category. And if you're talking about like hours and like store specifics, hours, locations, things like that, those are going to go into a different category. And then you start talking about how do you name those categories in an intuitive way? And then you have people come in and check, like, did it make sense that ice cream flavors was in a category called flavors? Probably. And of course, the more complex topics you have, the harder this gets. But that's just one example of how you take the content, you mock it up, whether on paper or with the card sort. You have other people come in and test it. You get their feedback, you integrate that feedback, and then you test it again. You make the adjustments and you go for another round of refinement. And you do that again and again and again until you have something that you feel confident bringing into a digital space, because paper is cheap, but code is expensive. And so you definitely don't want your whatever's being developed in code to be your first attempt. So by the time you're at that particular stage, you should be pretty confident. You should have had a couple test runs and hopefully have a graphic designer on your team who is able to make it look pretty. So you don't have to be an artist to get to like the paper prototype stage. But once you want to start converting it into a digital or a more formalized product, even if it's a physical product, then you do need to bring in people like graphic designers and coders and things like that, so that the product has a polished appearance, because it is important. It may seem superficial, but if it looks like it was coded by a third grader or drawn by a third grader, you know, you're going to have a very different impression than if it was something that was professionally done. And with a topic as, I think, as sensitive as mental health, having that appearance of professionalism is really important to conveying to people that they can trust you and that you know what you're doing and that you're not just trying to bootstrap something together.
I worked for a company once that had built this software. And I think they spent so much money on the front end on making it look good and the process and you know the UX that they couldn't get the actual software to work.
Oh, no.
So the way what happened was the software was just pretty much just sending data somewhere, and there was someone who by hand was doing all of the movement and allocation and calculations in the background and then bringing that up back to the front. It wasn't happening in real time, obviously, but it can go the other way too, where you have one part, like you focus too much on one part and not on the other.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of I've adopted this model of a design sprint. I read a book a couple years back from Jake Knapp called Sprint, and it's KNAPP from the Google Ventures team. So it's just like Google has this group that goes out to people who want to start new projects and like new startups, and then they go and they do these week-long design sprints with them. And then the book is this really cool model that I've used it pretty much everywhere I've worked since I read the book, and every project I've done some version of it. And I've met with other companies who also have UX teams, and they have all sorts of cool stuff. But I think it goes back to, like, if I want to work with iThrive, you can walk me through that design process, and I think somebody, you know, someone else should walk the research lab through that process while they're doing it. But then there needs to be money for that to happen. Either research lab needs to hire somebody internally to be like the liaison for that type of thing. Actually, a few years ago, I interviewed for a federal job. They have, it's called the OPM lab. And the OPM lab is essentially like what you're describing for the federal government. So they have this team that goes out to different agencies to help them like make that website look better, make your stuff work better for your employees. Like, there's no reason why we need 300 steps when 4 will do, you know, all of that type of stuff. There are lots of people out there who know how to do this. If you're in the game space and in the mental health space, it sounds like iThrive is a good place to go to. But there's like an education piece too. I don't know, like I'm hoping that if someone's listening to this and has an idea or works at a lab and has no idea how to make first of all, there's a degree of awareness. Like sometimes you don't know that your app looks like garbage. That one's really hard. Like,
that's truth bomb, man. That's hard. That's tough.
Does your app look really different from the other apps on the App Store? I just look at everything else out there. I just signed up for a sleep study on the App Store.
Ooh.
Let me see. The university is the... Oh, it's not a university. It's the American Sleep Apnea Association. And they're partnered with the university. I forgot. Partners at the University of California, San Diego. Right? They created this app. It's a sleep study app. And it is gorgeous. It is fantastic. It even has like tests for you to do. And it is mining my personal information like you have no idea. It is asking me really personal stuff. And I'm just giving it away. You know why? Because it's a good-looking app.
Because you trust it.
I don't know. I mean, I want to contribute. I mean, that's part of the thing, right? Like I want to contribute in this sense. And there's some apps that I really want. Like, we talked about SuperBetter before. SuperBetter hasn't been updated in a really long time. Mm. There was a while where SuperBetter wasn't even scaled to the newest size of iPhone. Like it was still on the iPhone 4 size. And then it wouldn't scale out to the iPhone 5 size. And it's like you ran out of money at that point, right? Like, I understand that a lot of these apps, it's a money issue. Like I keep coming back to the fact that it's a money issue. There needs to be some sort of, like there needs to be a consensus within your team that you have to allocate money for that to be able to hire a company or hire somebody internally or just talk to people, even if it's just consulting, do something. Like don't get the cheapest coder out there, because then you're going to end up with a lot of these apps that look really bad are just coded in like Flash and then put into, and it's basically a web-based app that was made into a regular app, and it's like, there's so many options. Like I could talk about this for a really, really long time, but ultimately get money.
But you bring up a really good point, and I'm glad you said that, is the idea that, and I think that was kind of the main gist of this particular presentation too, is that since, you know, the big muckety mucks in the room at the time was you need to make this part of your budget. Like it, mm-hmm. it's tough when you're having to bring in other disciplines that are outside your own silo to know where to go and where to look and how to estimate those kinds of things. But if you want a product that is going to be successful, however you want to define successful, if you want any kind of commercial success, if you want people to actually use the tool, like if that's how you're measuring success, then you need to make sure that the tool is usable. Like even if it's ugly, it needs to be usable. And so when you are, you know, doing your research grant and you're trying to create these mobile apps to help people deal with mental health issues, it's critically important that you budget in both financially and time-wise for this kind of iterative and interdisciplinary process. Like it needs to work and you need to test it to make sure it works and then have time to integrate the feedback from that testing and try again and get more feedback and try again. And, you know, I think that's just, it's a really important strategy that the tech industry has embraced and known all along. And this is trying to encourage more traditional researchers to at least consider, at least think about and have in their brains that, you know, this is not about being superficially pretty. This is about being able to deliver really important content to people who want it in a way that they can access and they feel comfortable with.
And you need to let go of some of the things that you're holding on to, because this is something that happens a lot when you hire a designer or something like that. You're like, no, but I really want 7 different elements in my logo and I really want it blue, this particular blue. It's like, listen to the designers in the room. Let them like some of that stuff, like just hand it off to them, because as long as your thing does the thing that it needs to do, don't worry so much about these, about the color, about how many buttons are there, because a lot of that is like, there are people who know more about that than you do probably if you're in a lab doing psych research.
Yeah, and I can't stress that enough. I was actually making a graphic for my husband the other day, and it's like a, hey, you know, this person's going to be doing a town hall. And so I made it. I'm like, okay, this is beautiful. My color palette is on point. Like I have dynamics, all sorts of stuff going on. And he's like, I don't like how this line and this line aren't the same. And I told him, well, that's too bad, because that would make it ugly and not have the flow that I want it to have. And thankfully he said, oh, okay, and moved on. But yeah, getting caught up on stuff like that, you, like Josue said, sometimes you need to let go. And that's why, at least in this process, finding...
Although in this example, you're the psychologist who didn't want to let go of a particular thing that they made. I'm not saying that your husband knows more about design than you do.
He doesn't. Saying
it's pretty funny that that's the example you brought up.
I went to design school, all right?
My
master's literally has the word design in it. Mm-hmm. But it's because if I made that adjustment to be what he wanted, the power of the image would have been lessened. Like it wouldn't have the impact that he wanted. So and that's kind of like the core thing. Like, what is the most important thing to you? Is it the most important thing, the color? Is it the shape? Or is it the information about where people can go to this gosh darn town hall and who it's for? It's the content? Okay, then just let me make the content look as good as it possibly can. And that's what I did. And that's why I pushed back when he told me to change it, because it would have made the content less readable. It would have taken the core aspect and made it less prominent and less like able to take in at a glance-ish. I'm sure there's a word for that, but I don't know it.
Also, if you don't know where to start, just steal it. Steal Like an Artist?
Yes, there's actually a book called How to Steal Like an Artist.
Yep, by Austin Kleon. It's fantastic. Just find something that you like. That's how I didn't go to design school. So pretty much that's how I start with everything. I'm like, ooh, I really like the way that looks. Maybe I can try to make something similar. And then I don't get there, but along the way, I find what I was looking for.
And that's totally a legitimate strategy. Like it absolutely is.
Yep.
And I guess just to kind of wrap this up, Stephen mentioned that like the future of digital mental health, one is that people really want technology that supports their mental health, which I think is a really good sign for people who want to create in this space, that there definitely is an audience for it. To avoid skeuomorphs. So just because it works in the physical world does not mean that it is going to translate perfectly to the digital, and try and break away from those kinds of assumptions. And then when you are in the development stage, he said to lower the bar for entry. So allow the developers to learn fast So in terms of, you know, iterate as much as you can, make something, get critique, throw it away, start something, you know, and just like get through all your bad ideas first, so that you can get to your good ones. And then, you know, engage users throughout the process. So not just like when you have a draft, but engage them at the beginning. Is this something you even want? Is this something you're even interested in? What would you like to see if this was to exist? What might it look like? And what would you not want it to look like? And I think that is such a critical piece that everyone can take away and learn from who's trying to design anything, you know, whether you're a researcher or you're working in tech or you're making games. Like, know who your end users are and engage them in your process, because that's going to help you so much in terms of later down the line when you're not going to run into the issue of, oh, well, they don't like that, or, oh, this idea is stupid and nobody actually wants it. So yeah, keep your end users in mind, I think would be the finishing point.
Yeah, those are all good points, and I think it's something that we don't think about, and we weren't taught in school, especially back in the day.
I was taught in design school, so
yeah, most people didn't go to the design school.
I know, so. Because they're not addicted to education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like I am.
They
don't have a problem like I do.
Yeah, they weren't like, I'm done with the PhD, but I need more.
I need more.
So, I mean, I'm going to put a link to that book, that sprint book,
in the
thing, because in the show notes, because I think it's super helpful. It has a lot of those points that you just laid out. Like, one of my favorite ones is you have to have a decider on the team.
Like, decider.
Yeah. Like, that person has to, like, assign one person. That person makes a final decision. Because if you all try to have a consensus, or everybody tries to, like, no, but I want this, I want that, it's not going to go well. You need to make a decision at some point. And sometimes the easiest way to do that is just having who's in charge. Okay, that person has final say, and we're done, and we move forward. Because if you don't move forward, you can't then do it again. Like, you can't reiterate again. You can't start again. You can't move forward in the process. You're just going to get stuck. Like in your example from before, you were the decider.
Yes, I am. I am the decider. But yeah, the idea that design by committee, it doesn't work. So just don't, like, you need a point person who can make those decisions.
Yep. And you do it before anything is even happening, just so everybody's clear. Yes, I'll put that in the book.
You might also want to include the book that you were just mentioning, How to Steal Like an Artist. Like, that's a really important one. And there's another one. There's a book called Smashing UX Design. So if anybody's interested in the UX space, that's a really valuable book. And there's another one that I'm trying to think of. The cover is of a backwards teapot. And it has to do with, like, the design of everyday objects. Maybe that's what it's called, Design of Everyday Objects. Hold on, I'm going to... Everyday Things, because that's a really amazing book for anybody who is interested in just, like, honing their design chops and just getting a little bit more about how do I design something that doesn't suck.
Yeah, The Design of Everyday Things by Don Norman.
Yes, that's it. Yes. I highly recommend that book. It's great. So that's it. That's it for me. That's all. That's my rant.
I'm sorry you had to sit through all those ugly slide presentations, but...
The good thing was that I was live tweeting the event, so I really wasn't focused on the ugliness of the slides. It was like, take a picture, type really fast, tweet, take another picture, type really fast, tweet, thread those tweets together. It was almost like an adrenaline rush, like the nerdiest adrenaline rush that's ever existed.
That's cool, because my timeline was just ugly slide after ugly slide after ugly slide.
I threaded them
rough.
So that your wood.
Hard.
I tried. I'm sorry. I'm very impressed that you did not unfollow me during that time.
No. I almost removed you from a Twitter list that I have because you messed up my timeline that day. I should have blocked you for the day for that. No, there's some good stuff there.
Yep. So check it out. And if you have any questions about the slides, I'm more than happy to talk about them. But yeah, that was the APA Technology, Mind, and Society Conference. And yeah, so you can see the stuff that I live tweeted throughout that. And this is where Josue takes over and talks about if you want to get to know us more.
If you want to get to know us more... Visit psychdivepodcast.com, where you'll find more episodes and links to all the things that we just talked about. You can also, all those books will be in the show notes, so just look down at your phone, look at the description, everything should be there. We're on Twitter, at psychtechcast. I'm at Josue Cardona, and Kelly is Kelly N. Dunlap. We're part of the Geek Therapy Podcast Network, so check out the Geek Therapy community group on Facebook. It is very active, very cool. And you can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/geektherapy. Find us everywhere on the internet. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. You've just listened to Psych Tech on the Geek Therapy Podcast Network. For more about Geek Therapy and our other podcasts, visit geektherapy.com. And for extra content, including our monthly book club and other perks, consider supporting us for as little as $1 a month at our Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/geektherapy.